the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 14. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a mostly cloudy day. Winds will be from the northwest at 5 to 15 miles per hour. And Cedar Rapids will see a high of 25. We'll see 26 in Iowa City, falling to a low tonight of 14 in Cedar Rapids, 15 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 4:46 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 7:28 a.m. for a total daylight period of 9 hours and 19 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, derecho repairs nearly over at Kennedy High, a story by Grace King of the Gazette staff. After the August 10 derecho swept through Cedar Rapids, Associate Principal Jessica Johnson walked through Kennedy High School ankle-deep in water to survey the destruction. The roof was severely damaged, leaving gaping holes in the ceiling for water to gush in and flood the library, classrooms, the auditorium, and the gymnasium. Reconstruction crews have been working for more than 4 months to get the high school safe for students who've been in online learning since school started in September. Crews are scheduled to be out of the building January 4, and Kennedy teachers and staff will have a workday January 8 to prepare their classrooms for students to return. I think everyone is wanting to come home again, Johnson said. There's a lot of apprehension on what it's going to look like with COVID-19 protocols, but we're working hard to make sure students and staff feel safe. When students return mid-January, they will be in hybrid learning, with half of students attending school on campus and half attending online every other day. About 800 students will be on campus each day. Kennedy wasn't the only Cedar Rapids school damaged in the derecho, but certainly was the most devastated. The district delayed the first day of school for all students until September 21. To give time for buildings to be repaired. It was able to open all 21 elementary schools for in-person learning. Franklin, McKinley, Taft, middle schools, and Kennedy, Jefferson, and Washington high schools began online classes only because of the derecho damage. Students at Franklin, McKinley, Jefferson, and Washington returned to in-person classes last Wednesday. Taft students return to in-person classes today. Kennedy principal Jason Klein spent a day at Washington High last week to observe its coronavirus protocols. Klein was at Kennedy when the derecho hit. He was watching the storm through a window when he noticed water pouring into the school. People were running through the building with garbage cans trying to catch the water, Klein said. We left to see what happened to our own homes and came back the next day, and it was surreal. It was pitch black in the building. I saw the holes in the ceiling, and I thought it was a lot worse than it looked the day of the storm. Being in a high school during the pandemic and seeing how it was operating was eye-opening, Klein said. He's most concerned about how to safely serve lunch. The high school is putting desks in the cafeteria instead of tables to more easily keep students 6 feet apart. Because of the derecho, the school's sports teams have been without a home base this fall. The volleyball team has practiced at Harding Middle School and Corridor Courts, a volleyball club in Marion. The swim team has held practice at Washington, Jefferson, and Linmar High Schools. Kennedy Athletic Director Aaron Stecker said teams gathering together pre- and post-practice typically is a time for connection, bonding, and team chemistry. Fall athletics didn't get to have that this year. It's great for a school community to celebrate wins and mourn losses together, Stecker said. If a volleyball team wins a tough match Tuesday night, on Wednesday morning they get to see their friends and they're okay. Now they lose a tough match and they're at home by themselves. There's so much to be said for being able to walk into the school and have your peers and friends give you a pat on the back and say, great game, he added. Stecker is looking forward to having a completely new floor in the gym. The original floors were from 1967, he said. Stecker is ready for the building to once again be filled with the energy students and staff bring. He has some good friends on staff he hasn't seen since March, when the schools first closed for the pandemic. Does the idea of bringing 800 people back to the school make me nervous in terms of COVID-19 and managing that? Yeah, it does. But I think we're ready to go, Stecker said. We have to give it a shot. We're not designed to learn behind computer screens. And also from the front page of today's Gazette, vaccine shipments begin in historic effort. This is a national story from Portage, Michigan, but obviously with direct implications to all of us here in eastern Iowa. The first of many freezer-packed COVID-19 vaccine vials made their way to distribution sites across the United States on Sunday as the nation's pandemic deaths approached the horrifying new milestone of 300,000. The rollout of the Pfizer vaccine, the first to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration, ushers in the biggest vaccination effort in U.S. history, one that health officials hope the American public will embrace, even as some has voiced initial skepticism or worry. Shots are expected to be given to healthcare workers and nursing home residents beginning today. Quick transport is key for the vaccine, especially since this one must be stored at extremely low temperatures, about 94 degrees below zero. Early Sunday, workers at Pfizer, dressed in fluorescent yellow clothing, hard hats and gloves, wasted no time as they packed vials into boxes. They scanned the packages and then placed them into freezer cases with dry ice. The vaccines were then taken from Pfizer's Portage, Michigan facility to Gerald R. Ford International Airport in Grand Rapids, where the first cargo plane took off amid what airport officials called a jubilant mood. This is a historic day, said Richard W. Smith, who oversees operations in the Americas for FedEx Express, which is delivering 630-some packages of vaccine to distribution sites across the country. United Parcel Service also is transporting a share of the vaccine. Helping with the transport of the vaccine has special meaning to Bruce Smith, a FedEx package handler at the Grand Rapids Airport, whose older sister, Queen, died after she contracted coronavirus in May. She was hospitalized in Georgia one day after he saw her on a video chat, and they never spoke again. I think she would be ecstatic to know that something that has ravaged our family, that a family member is going to be a part of such a big project, said Smith, age 58, whose nephew, Queen's son, also got sick and is still undergoing therapy for stroke-like symptoms. It's very, very important. Tracked with GPS-enabled sensors, the initial shipments were expected to contain about 3 million doses, with many more to come. Federal officials say the first shipment of Pfizer's vaccine will be staggered, arriving in 145 distribution centers today, with another 425 sites getting shipments Tuesday, and the remaining 66 on Wednesday. Doses of the vaccine, co-developed by German partner BioNTech, are given out based on each state's adult population. Then the states decide where they go first. In California, where healthcare workers will be among the first to be vaccinated, state health officials are prioritizing hospitals that have adequate storage capacity, serve high-risk populations, and have the ability to vaccinate people quickly. Initial surveys have found that even some healthcare workers don't want to be first in line. Dr. Graham Snyder, who's led the vaccine task force at Pennsylvania healthcare giant UPMC, estimates that about half of its employees are willing to get the vaccine as soon as it's offered. But many health officials expect enthusiasm to grow. There's that thought that maybe they don't have to be so afraid to come to work if they can be vaccinated and be immune, said Dr. Sandra Kemmerly, Medical Director of Hospital Quality at the 40 Hospital Ochsner Health System in Louisiana and Mississippi. Senior U.S. government officials, including some White House officials who work in proximity to President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, are among those who will be offered coronavirus vaccines as soon as this week, two people familiar with the matter confirmed. A survey from the Associated Press, NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, found that about half of Americans want to get the vaccine as soon as possible. Another quarter aren't sure, while the remaining quarter say they aren't interested. Some simply oppose vaccines in general. Others are concerned that the vaccines have been rushed and want to see how the rollout goes. Dr. Stephen Hahn, commissioner of the FDA, which approved the Pfizer vaccine on Friday, has repeatedly insisted that the agency's decision was based on science, not politics, despite a White House threat to fire him if the vaccine wasn't approved before Saturday. The Moderna vaccine will be reviewed by an expert panel Thursday and soon afterward could be allowed for public use. And in another vaccine article from Des Moines by Aaron Murphy of the Des Moines Bureau, the COVID-19 pandemic reached Iowa 9 months ago. It has claimed the lives of more than 3,000 Iowans, including at least one in each of the state's 99 counties, and has infected more than a quarter million Iowans. Businesses have been forced to close, some temporarily, others permanently. Workers have found themselves out of a job, and schools have tried to educate students virtually. As the virus continues to surge through Iowa 9 months into the pandemic, help is on the way. Three companies have created COVID-19 vaccines, and the federal government has approved the first on an emergency basis for mass public distribution. Such an unprecedented effort creates many questions about the vaccine, and here are 10 of them, with answers from state officials, federal and state public health experts, and the state's 70-page vaccination strategy plan. Question one is, when will vaccines be available? Answer is, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca say they have developed effective COVID-19 vaccines. Pfizer's is furthest along and received emergency use approval late Friday. Officials said, barring unforeseen bumps in the road, they expect to receive the first batch of the Pfizer vaccine as soon as today, and then more deliveries each week through December. State officials said the first batch of Moderna's vaccine could be delivered the week of December 20. State officials expect that, between the two vaccines, about 172,000 doses should arrive this month in Iowa. Next question, who gets it first and who decides that? The vaccine distribution in Iowa is decided by state public health officials who are using guidance from the federal government. The state has formed an advisory committee of experts to provide guidance. Based on that federal advice, Iowa has determined the first doses will be made available to hospital and other healthcare workers and staff and residents in long-term care facilities like nursing homes. More than 120,000 Iowans work in hospitals and nursing and residential care facilities, and more than 22,000 individuals live in certified nursing facilities, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Once those Iowans have received the vaccine, state officials have determined the vaccine at that point will be made available to workers who perform essential functions in workplace settings where it is difficult to socially distance. That group, the state has determined, will include emergency and law enforcement personnel, food packaging and distribution workers, teachers and school staff, and child care workers. Also at this point, residents of assisted living programs and elder group homes with adults and adults with medical conditions that make them more vulnerable to severe COVID-19 will be eligible. Eventually, the vaccine will become available to the rest of the public. Experts say that could take until spring or summer. Next question, where can I get the vaccine when ready? For those people who have been prioritized, the vaccine will be made available through their workplace or the long-term care facility where they work or live. Some pharmacies also will be able to administer the vaccine to those early populations through a national program. CVS, Walgreens, and Community Pharmacy have partnered with the federal government to help distribute the vaccine. Once the vaccine becomes more widely available, the state will work to establish vaccination clinics at myriad sites, including pharmacies, community clinics, free clinics, nonprofit agencies, schools, community centers, and more. Next question, will I be required to get the vaccine? Answer, no state official has said Iowans will be required to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Next question, how much will the vaccine cost me? Answer, the federal government is making all taxpayer-funded vaccine doses available for free. Providers may charge an administrative fee for providing the shot, but that fee can be recouped through insurance or through a federal relief fund, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Next question, is the vaccine safe? The federal approval process determines whether a vaccine is safe before approving its distribution. If the vaccines are approved by the federal government, those experts have determined it is safe for Americans to receive the vaccines as outlined in the approval. The University of Iowa is among the sites that have conducted trials on the Pfizer vaccine, which means some people in Iowa already have received the vaccine in those clinical trials. Next question, is it effective? Based on trials conducted while developing the vaccines, Pfizer's and Moderna's vaccines are both roughly 95% effective. AstraZeneca says its vaccine, which is in earlier stages of trials, is 70% effective. Question, how many vaccine doses do you need? Both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines require the individual to receive two doses taken on separate occasions. The Pfizer vaccine must be taken 3 weeks apart and the Moderna vaccine 4 weeks apart. Individuals must take the same company's vaccine in both doses for it to be effective. Skipping the second vaccine could render it ineffective, especially if many people do that, experts say. The federal government is paying providers significantly more to provide the second shot as an incentive for providers to ensure their patients receive both doses. Question, why do I need a card and how do I get it? Answer, those who receive the vaccine will be given a COVID-19 vaccination record card when they receive the first dose. The card will help public health officials determine who has received the vaccination and help ensure individuals follow through with the second shot. It will contain only basic information like name, date of birth, a patient number, and dates. Last question. Afterward, can I stop wearing a mask? Answer. Public health experts recommend individuals who receive the vaccine continue to practice virus mitigation habits, such as washing hands, staying at least 6 feet away from others, and wearing a mask when in public around others. Experts need to understand more about the protection that COVID-19 vaccines provide before deciding to change recommendations on steps everyone should take to slow the spread of the virus that causes COVID-19, the CDC says. Other factors, including how many people get vaccinated and how the virus is spreading in communities, will also affect this decision. And from the Iowa Today section, it is pure exhaustion. Frontline healthcare workers describe working through the COVID surge. This is a story by Aaron Murphy, also of the Gazette, Lee, Des Moines, Bureau. From Des Moines, exhaustion, physical and emotional exhaustion. That's what Iowa's frontline healthcare workers are feeling right now as COVID-19 rages through the state 9 months into the pandemic. Frontline healthcare workers have been dealing with the pandemic since it reached Iowa in March. Almost 9 months later, COVID-19 surged through Iowa at a rate never before seen. Cases quadrupled their previous high, and hospitalizations tripled their previous highest mark set in May. That unprecedented surge left Iowa hospitals reeling, and the workers on the front lines are feeling the impact deeply. The refrain from those workers is consistent. They are physically and emotionally exhausted. To have the worst of it happening so long into this battle, everybody was already tired, and now everyone's working even harder than they were, said Kristen Brainard, a nurse practitioner in the intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. It is pure exhaustion, and it's not just a physical thing. This is a lot of mental exhaustion for all of us. Nurses interviewed for this story said they do not feel short-staffed in part because their hospitals have taken necessary steps like shifting nurses from other areas to help care for COVID-19 patients. But they said their work became increasingly taxing as the number of COVID hospitalizations skyrocketed in November. For much of the pandemic, the highest two-week average of daily new COVID-related hospital admissions statewide was 40. On November 22, that average was 211. The surge has forced nurses and other frontline workers to work long hours, often in areas in which they are not accustomed to working. Everybody is getting called upon to go a little bit beyond and above what you're typically doing. And actually, we've been doing this for quite a few months now, and everybody is really tired of it, said Barbara Stenerson, a senior physical therapist at UIHC. But you know, we're still there for the patients, and we're doing everything we can to make it safe and to get those patients back on their feet. The job has taken an emotional toll as well as nurses have to watch COVID patients die, often without family members at their side, due to safety precautions. I've been a nurse for over a decade now, and it's one of the hardest battles I've ever had to fight in my life at work, said Lily Olson, a nurse in the medical intensive care unit at UIHC, her voice cracking with emotion as she spoke. We try our darndest every day, and unfortunately, we lose battles. We don't like it. It affects us a lot, emotionally, mentally, physically, because it's exhausting work. Olson spoke over a video call while preparing lunch for her three children, some of whom could be heard in the background. She said it's not just the job that weighs on healthcare workers, it's bringing the job home, figuratively, by still reeling from the physical and emotional effects of a shift and literally with the fear of contracting the virus and spreading it to their families. I come home from work and I just want to go to bed, even though there's other things I have to do, Olson said. It's not just a work thing, because when we're at home, we think about work. It didn't used to be that way for me. I used to be able to come home relaxed and not worry about it. But you're physically exhausted. I have three kids to take care of. Three kids is a lot of work. It's hard to give them my full energy because I use a lot of it at work, said Cynthia Marula, an internal medicine nurse at UIHC. In the back of your mind, you're thinking of your own families. You're trying to be as thorough as possible, using safety precautions, because you just do not want to take it home to a family member. And it's not just their own families which healthcare workers are concerned. They also feel for the families of COVID patients. Often family members are unable to visit because of safety concerns. I just feel so terrible because one of the main and most important things for good patient outcomes is to have them on that support system, is to have their families close. And these people don't have that. They can't have it in the way they need it. The risk is just too high, Marula said. COVID is just making devastation across everywhere. Nurses said they have been even forced to have difficult end-of-life discussions with family members over the phone instead of in person. There's good news. The recent surge may be subsiding, and COVID-19 vaccines are on the way. After hitting those dangerous and unprecedented peaks in late November, COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations have been declining over the past 2 weeks. However, those figures still remain dramatically higher than the previous peak over the summer, and the first batches of the vaccine are expected to arrive in Iowa this week. The state, based on federal guidance, has determined hospital and other healthcare workers, along with staff and residents at long-term care facilities, such as nursing homes, will be prioritized to receive the vaccinations first. But it will be months before the vaccine is available to the general public, experts said. In the meantime, those frontline workers pleaded with Iowans not to let their guard down in the ongoing battle to prevent the virus's spread. They asked everyone to continue washing their hands, staying 6 feet away from others outside of their home, and wearing face masks when in public around others. My number one thing is not to let a stabilization of cases make you put your guard down. The moment that those guards come down in the community and people tend to relax on restrictions and mandates, that is COVID's prime opportunity to wreak havoc, Marula said. It's just so important to be vigilant, to be cautious, to do your part in the community to contain it. Marula implored Iowans to do their part, not just to help healthcare workers, but to save lives. Even if you don't care about getting COVID, if you could care less if you got it, do it for your mother or your sibling. Do it for your own child, she said. Love somebody enough to protect them. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 14, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, James Matthew Macek, or Masek, M-A-C-E-K, age 76, died on Wednesday, December 9, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House. Funeral Mass for Jim will be held at St. Ludmilla's Catholic Church. Burial will be in the Czech National Cemetery. Public visitation will be from 2 to 7 p.m. Thursday, December 17, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Also from Cedar Rapids, Beth Ann Thibodeau, age 70, passed away at her home on Friday, December 11. A celebration of Beth's life will be held at a future date. The Popich Kuba Funeral Service is serving the family. From Cedar Rapids, Richard, also known as Bud Havlick, age 92, died Friday, December 11, at his home. A private celebration of life services will be held at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, and burial will be in the Czech National Cemetery. Also from Cedar Rapids, Carl James Hoffman, age 84, passed away on December 12 from complications of COVID-19. A celebration of his life will be held at a later date. And from Williamsburg, Patricia, also known as Pat McDonough, age 82, passed away on Friday, December 11, at her home. Private funeral services will be held at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Friends are welcome to attend the burial at 2:30 p.m. Monday, December 14, at St. Mary's Cemetery in Williamsburg. From Newton, Ernest Jr. Jones, age 93, and currently residing in Marion, Iowa, died on Sunday, December 6, at Winslow House Care Facility in Marion. A funeral and celebration of life services will be held at a later time. And from Lone Tree, Cheryl Lynn Alberhasky, age 53, died on Thursday, December 10, following an unexpected illness. Family funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 16, at the Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. There will be no public visitation. Friends are welcome to join the family by way of Zoom. And the link may be found on Cheryl's obituary page at www.lansingfuneral.com. Friends are welcome to attend the graveside committal service at 12:30 p.m. Wednesday at the Lone Tree Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Joan Powell, age 65, died Thursday at her home. Services will be held at a later date. The Murdoch-Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. And from Cedar Rapids, Arthur Lynn Zvaldi, age 82, formerly of Manchester, was quietly drawn home to the light on December 12th. A private family entombment will be in the Linwood Mausoleum in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And from Center Point, Lois D. McNeil, age 88, died on Friday, December 11. A funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 16, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Center Point. Burial in Center Point Cemetery. From Toulon, Illinois, Ellen Stiegelmeyer, age 88, formerly of Vinton and Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully in her sleep on Thursday, December 10, after losing her battle with COVID-19. A private graveside burial and service will be held at a future date at Bishop Cemetery in Amana. From Iowa City, Dorothy Elaine Belger, at the age of 86 on December 11, God in His mercy called Dorothy to be home and reunited with her husband Charles Berger. A private family interment was held at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa on Monday, December 14. From Iowa City, Carol Stroyan of Johnson County died of Alzheimer's disease on December 11. Carol's remains will be interred in her mother's grave in Pennsylvania at a family service. And from Traer, Alice Mae Zimple, age 86, passed away Friday, December 11, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. A private family graveside service will be held on Tuesday, December 15, at the Buckingham Cemetery in Traer. A walk-through visitation with limited number at one time will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 14, at Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama. And from Manchester, Colleen L. Hirsch, age 70, died December 9 in her home after fighting a long battle with cancer. Due to COVID-19, services will be held at a later date. From Marion, Dennis M. Cunningham, age 59, passed away on Friday, December 11 at his home in Marion, surrounded by his family. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. A celebration of Dennis's life will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, December 18, at Cornerstone Church, located at 925 Blair's Ferry Road in Marion, where the family will greet friends for 1 hour prior to the service. From Walford, Douglas Stephen Stulkin, age 51, passed away on Friday, December 11, at the Mercy Medical Center. Private family mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Jude Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Interment will be held at the Cedar Memorial Cemetery. And from Marion, Gerald, also known as Jerry Patrick McNamara, age 71, of Marion, passed away Saturday, December 12, at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A mass of Christian burial for family and friends will be held at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. Committal services will follow at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. And from Cedar Rapids, Betty Jean Mice, age 89, passed away peacefully Friday, December 11, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospice in Cedar Rapids due to complications of congestive heart failure. Private family funeral mass at 10 a.m., Tuesday, December 15, burial at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, and arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. From Hiawatha, Valerie Louise Henson, age 67, passed away on Friday following a long illness. As per the family's wishes, private services will be held at a later date. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids are in charge of arrangements. From Vinton, Bonnie G. Rickhart, age 81, passed away peacefully on Friday, December 11, at her home with her children by her side. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, December 17, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel at 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. Interment will be held at the Urbana Cemetery at a later date. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. until service time at the funeral home on Thursday. From Wyoming, Rose I. Mirror, age 90, passed away peacefully in her home on December 9, surrounded by her family. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 14, at Dawson Funeral Services in Wyoming. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, December 15, at the Wyoming United Methodist Church. Burial will take place at a later date in the Wyoming Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Gary Lee Eschen, age 69, died on Saturday, December 12, at Mercy Medical Center from complications of COVID-19. Private family funeral services will be held on Wednesday, December 16, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Interment will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. And in other death notices from Decorah, Daryl Fry, age 81, died Saturday, December 12. The Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is handling arrangements. From Hiawatha, Norma Thorin, age 93, died Saturday, December 12. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Iowa City, Catherine C. Welcher, age 74, died Friday, December 11. The Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon is assisting the family. From Manchester, Roberta Jean, also known as Bobby Chester, age 71, died Sunday, December 13. The Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester is assisting the family. And from Manchester, Frederick Charles Reese, age 76, died Saturday, December 12. The Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Edgewood is assisting the family. From Maquoketa, Wayne Adrian, age 87, died Saturday, December 12. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. From Olwine, Beverly A. Stegall, age 81, died Friday, December 11. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine is assisting the family. From Sigourney, Mildred Mather, age 93, died Friday, December 11. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is assisting the family. And in other death notices, the Reverend Lloyd Edward Reuter, age 91, of Gilbertville, Iowa, died on Wednesday, December 9. The White Funeral Home in Jessup is assisting the family. And we have a high school volleyball story today from the sports section, entitled All the Way Back. It's a story by Jeff Linder of the Gazette staff. Not all of Jasmine Yomolkowski's post-surgery rehabilitation was physical. "After surgery, my body just felt different," she said. "I had always been comfortable making cuts. I felt quick, but I didn't feel that way anymore, and it really wore on me. I was really struggling, and I didn't know if I was ever going to feel like an athlete again, physically or mentally." A senior setter for the Cedar Rapids Xavier volleyball team, Yalmakoski suffered a torn labrum in her left hip, diagnosed shortly after Xavier's 2019 season. She had surgery in January and was on crutches for 7 weeks and couldn't run until April. "I got into a mental block," she said. "For a long time, my confidence was super low. Her path back was a long one, but not a lonely one. Usually it's the setter that sticks around to give her hitters extra reps. In this case, it was the other way around. Elise Winter and Katie Garrison, some other girls they'd stay after practice, Yomlikowski said, or we'd work out late on a Friday night. They wanted to help me out. They wanted their old center back. They needed her to chase down that elusive state championship. In the end, they got both. Yomlikowski averaged 10.31 assists per set, and Xavier, at 26-6, flipped the switch once the postseason started, sweeping its way to the Class 4A title. A four-year starter and a Tennessee Tech recruit, Yomlikowski is the 2020 Gazette Area Player of the Year. She has always had the ability to perform on the court, Xavier coach Austin Filer said. This year she grew a lot as a leader. Once she came back from her injury, she was the catalyst to get kids to work hard, to do the things that they didn't want to do in order for us to win a championship. The 4A State Player of the Year, Yomlikowski, headlines a 12-player area roster, also honored our Xavier's Eve McGill, Iowa City Liberty's Cassidy Hartman, and Shelby Kim, Mount Vernon's Sydney Dennis, and Lauren Schrock, Meg Bessler of Western Dubuque, Macy Daufelt of West Liberty, Ella Kolak of West Delaware, Kirsten Schmidt of Dyersville Beckman, Belle Weber of Union Community, and Emerson Wittenbaugh of Maquoketa Valley. McGill is making her third appearance on the team, Schrock, Kolak, and Daufelt their second each. Randy Dolson, who piloted Liberty's run to the Class 5A finals after a three-week COVID-related interruption, is the Area Coach of the Year. Yomlikowski began her volleyball career at age 11. I wanted to be a setter because my mom was a setter, she said. I didn't have a position in fifth grade. Then in sixth grade, I didn't make any teams. By eighth grade, she was a setter for Six Pack, one of the best club teams in the Midwest. Then it was on to Xavier. Austin terrified me, Yomlikowski said. As time went on, I was able to adjust to him, and him to me, and we found a mutual trust. Dalton has coached the Lightning since the school opened in 2017, and the program has ascended quickly. Liberty is 89-41 with two state tournament appearances, and with a young crew of hitters, the best could yet to come. We're still building a tradition, Dolson, who has coached varsity for 35 years. We want to be a championship-caliber program for a long time to come, and we're not there yet. Liberty, at 24-3, was sitting at 1-1 early in the season when Iowa City schools went into virtual learning, shutting down the program. That didn't mean the girls didn't get together to stage some workouts, Dolson said. They were getting a lot of touches and staying fresh. Between taking temperatures, sanitizing equipment, and hand sanitizing, it was a heck of a team effort. At 1-1 on September 26, the Lightning took off and won 23 of their final 25 matches. They avenged regular season losses to West Des Moines Valley and West Des Moines Dowling at state before bowing to Ankeny in a four-set final. We had strong leadership. The girls set their goals high, Dolson said. They had a mission to win a state championship. They signed a statement and really bought into it. With four starters back, including Hartman and Young, the mission certainly will remain the same in 2021. Here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled Man Lets Anniversary Pass with No Celebration. Dear Abby, I've been married to my husband 25 years today. We've been a couple for 32 years. He has done nothing to commemorate this. I reminded him months ago to save for something because it was vital to me. Every year, it's the same old nothing. He asked me to remind him, and I did, but it made no difference. Same with my birthday. Yes, we have been in better positions financially than now, but if something is important to him, he saved for it. I have money put away we could have used, and he knew this, yet nothing. The only time he shows me any kind of emotion or love or sex is when he's drunk, but he swears he loves me. I don't suspect cheating. He doesn't care what he looks like when we go places. I always try to look my best. I'm at the end of my rope. This 25th anniversary really hurt me. He said we'll do something when he can. I can't take it anymore. I feel worthy of nothing, like I don't matter. What do I do? And that's signed Anniversary Sadness. And Abby responds, if the only time your husband shows you affectionate attention is when he is drunk, you have bigger problems than when he forgets special occasions. Is this the way you want to spend the next 25 years? Receiving gifts does not make a person worthy. You need to work on your level of self-esteem. As expensive as celebration might have been, a gift you could both benefit from would be couples counseling. And we have two letters to the editor today, the first coming from Vernon Trucano of Ottumwa. His letter is entitled, Count the Votes No Matter How Long It Takes. As an Iowan, I think we should count every vote, no matter how long it takes. We've lived in Ottumwa for 47 years, and we know that Iowa's second district election is separated by a difference of just 6 votes, making it the closest federal race in the country, and one of the closest in the last 100 years. Even after an initial recount, there are more ballots, including from Iowans in the military and living overseas, that have yet to be counted. Iowans deserve to have them counted. Democrat Rita Hart's decision to challenge this election before the House of Representatives instead of the Iowa District Court is the right one, given the 6-day timeline limitation for state elections contested in Iowa, and the volume of ballots left to be examined across 24 counties. It's just not possible to examine the ballots and evidence needed to ensure all Iowans' votes are accurately accounted in this historically close election. With the gap between Republican Marionette Miller Meeks and Hart standing at just 6 votes, it is essential that we make sure the results are accurate. That letter by Vernon Trucano of Ottumwa. And the next letter comes from Jonathan Bartholomew of Washington. This letter is entitled, Iowans, not D.C. politicians, deserve to decide our election. Iowans came out in historic numbers this year to support the candidates of their choice. Marionette Miller Meeks, a Republican from the 2nd Congressional District, worked hard to flip one of the most liberal congressional seats in our state. Victory was accomplished through the hard work of our newly elected and certified congresswoman, many extremely young Republicans, and the superior policies of the GOP. Recently, Rita Hart has announced that she will seek the overview of a U.S. House committee, thereby attempting to supersede the results of our election. Having personally overseen the process myself in 2 of our 24 counties, I can say with certainty it was handled with great care, coupled with the oversight of both political parties. If observers from either side had questions, we asked them together so we could understand everything during the counting process. If Rita Hart had a problem with the election, she should have taken the issue to Iowa judges. Instead, to my utter shock, she is taking our election to partisan politicians in Washington, D.C. for her own political gain. Regardless of political affiliation as Iowans, we need to condemn Rita Hart's selfish behavior. That letter by Jonathan Bartholomew of Washington. And we have a guest column today by Sarah Morgan Smith, and it's entitled Celebrate Your Holiday Knowledge. Although it will undoubtedly be different this year, the majority of people in the United States will celebrate Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights, from December 10 through 18, or Christmas, commemorating the birth of Jesus of Nazareth on December 25. The quiz below from the Ashbrook Center at Ashland University provides an opportunity for you to test your knowledge of the holidays. Here's the first question. In what year was Christmas declared a federal holiday? Answer A, 1870, B, 1898, C, 1921, or D, 1956? And the answer is A, 1870. Which U.S. president said, it is the day when we remind ourselves that man can and must live in peace with his neighbors, and that it is the peacemakers who are truly blessed in his annual Christmas message? Answer A, Woodrow Wilson, B, John F. Kennedy, C, Ronald Reagan, D, Barack Obama. And the answer is B, John F. Kennedy. Question 3. Which U.S. president had a Christmas tree farm on his property? A, Ulysses S. Grant, B, Calvin Coolidge, C, Franklin D. Roosevelt, or D, George W. Bush? And the answer is C. That would be Franklin D. Roosevelt. Question 4. Which president first lit the national menorah at the ellipse across from the White House? Answer A, Harry Truman, B, Lyndon Johnson, C, Gerald Ford, or D, Jimmy Carter? And the answer is D, Jimmy Carter. Question 5. The governor of which state said in a proclamation that the message of Hanukkah resonates powerfully with the fundamental principles of American life, because this nation was founded on the principles of hope and religious freedom? Answer A, Connecticut, B, Georgia, C, Iowa, or D, Nevada? And the answer is C, and that would be Iowa. Question 6. According to Jewish studies, Professor Tatiana Lichtenstein, by the 1950s, 40% of Jewish households in the U.S. city had Christmas trees. And that's the answer A is Boston, B, Chicago, C, Los Angeles, or D, New York City. And the answer is B, Chicago. Question 7. According to the book Hanukkah in America, A History, two rabbis from which city are responsible for popularizing Hanukkah in our country? A, Cincinnati, B, Minneapolis, C, Philadelphia, or D, Richmond? And the answer is A, Cincinnati. And question 8, what is Santa Claus called in Hawaii? Answer A, Kanakaloka, or Kamehameha, or C, Mahalo, or D, Ohana? And the answer is Kanakaloka. And question 9, Thomas Nast, the preeminent political cartoonist of the 19th century, popularized our modern vision of Santa Claus in the holiday illustrations he drew for which publication? Reader's Digest, A, B, The New Yorker, C, Harper's Weekly, or D, The Atlantic Monthly? And the answer was C, Harper's Weekly. And our final question, the U.S. Postal Service released its first Hanukkah stamp in what year? 1896, 1898, 1951, or the answer 2000? And the answer is A, 1996. And here's a story that comes from Seattle, but I think it applies to everyone here in Iowa too. And it's entitled, American Generosity This Year is No Match for COVID-19. From Seattle, charitable donations have reached records this year, but the pandemic is suffocating nonprofits. Organizations face soaring costs and demand for help, yet largely are without their own support systems, including volunteers and in-person fundraising events. December typically is the most important month for nonprofit revenues, but the Salvation Army, down 18% in funding this year, projects its Red Kettle campaign will net half as much as it did in 2019. Thousands of kettle donations have been eliminated because businesses that once hosted them have closed, and foot traffic has diminished as more people stay home. Its pool of volunteer bell ringers is smaller. Many don't participate now because they're at high risk for COVID-19. There's even a national coin shortage. Salvation Army's thrift stores are projected to take a $150 million hit this year. Arts organizations collectively have lost $14.6 billion in revenue to date this year, according to Americans for the Arts. The National Advocacy Group projects 12,000 arts and cultural nonprofits are at risk of being wiped out forever. But Woodrow Rosenbaum, Giving Tuesday's chief data officer, said arts and social services organizations will be integral to rebuilding community. They have a role of community, Rosenbaum said, and a role of healing. And our top weather story for today is entitled Snowpack is Keeping Us Cold. Even though the winter solstice is a week away, the arrival of snow this past weekend has made eastern Iowa look much more wintry, and it looks like we'll be keeping this new look for some time. Thanks in part to the fresh snowpack, temperatures through most of the upcoming work week will look to stay below freezing, topping out in the 20s and 30s most of the week. By the end of the week, we might start seeing some highs reaching above the freezing point into the upper 30s. Overnight lows will cool into the teens, with even colder wind chills some mornings. Slightly warmer weather will be expected in areas that saw less snow. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 14. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.